Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
The evidence and the counter-evidence. I'm struggling with that.
When the facts are filled with coincidences, don't dismiss those coincidences.
I have no tolerance for the unexplainable.
Well then, sir, you have no tolerance for me.
Hello and welcome to the second episode of Still Watching The Outsider. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair Chief Critic Richard Lawson.
If you are brand new to this podcast that we do, I just want to let you know that every week we watch and talk about the latest episode of an ongoing TV series. We are currently watching The Outsider on HBO Sunday nights. We will be discussing episode 3 and episode 3 alone. We will not be spoiling anything after episode 3, even though this show is based on a Stephen King book. And there's information out there from the book. We will not be spoiling stuff from the book or anything like that. So, this is it. Episode 3, when things get spooky and Cynthia Erivo shows up.
Yeah. Those things are not related. It just happens to be that Cynthia Erivo shows up. Actually, she's kind of like a force of like hope, I think, in the series thus far.
Yes.
But yeah, things get a little bit more supernatural.
Spooky rashes. All right. So, before we get into sort of our breakdown of the episode, I just want to let you guys know that if you want to email us, you can. Stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. We got an email this week from Charlotte, who writes in, I'm ready to say I'm excited you guys will be covering The Outsider. As a fan of the book, I was really anticipating the miniseries, and the first two episodes did not disappoint. So far, the show has nailed the mystery and the creepiness that the book captured so well. That said, I'm going to put the book completely aside and enjoy the series as its own entity. One thing stuck out to me, and I'm curious if it's a clue or a continuity error. The little girl who saw blood-covered Terry recalled him exiting the woods where the body was later found. He got into the white van and drove off. When the dog walker discovered the boy's body, the white van was parked in front of the woods again. But later the bouncer said blood-covered Terry left it in the club's employee parking lot. The detectives never mentioned this contradiction between the witnesses, so it was an error. So either it was an error the show made, or did blood-covered Terry bring the van back to the site of the murder and wait to be spotted by whomever discovered the body before going to the strip club? If so, that goes into the he's begging to be seen category, which is itself suspicious. I'm looking forward to more of this great story next week. Thanks, guys. From Charlotte. Yeah, it's intriguing. I mean, my gut kind of says continuity error. It does sort of play into what we've seen so far from this suspicious figure, which is like, let me make sure everyone sees my face and knows who I am, and knows for sure who I am, on this journey. So I don't know if you guys have thoughts about,
The van is like, the line from the episode 1 or 2, I think, when Ralph says, like, oh, it's like the van followed you home, you know? So, like, maybe the van is, I don't know, driving around on its own or something.
Oh, my God. I love that. That's some real Christine shit right there.
Mm-hmm.
If you have thoughts on Charlotte's email or the white van or locations or anything else, please do email us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. Before we sort of like run down the episode though, I kind of want to start with the arrival of this Holly Gibney character, Cynthia Erivo, and also chat with you a little bit, Richard. I'm at the TCA is the Television Critic Association press tour in LA right now. And during HBO's presentation day, they had a panel for the show. So I got to see Jason Bateman and Cynthia Erivo and Richard Price talking about it a little bit. So I want to, you know, sort of chat with you about some of the things they said there. But let's start first with Holly Gibney as a character, because Cynthia had some interesting things to say at the panel about it. So, Holly Gibney arrives. What do you make of her, introduction?
I like the way that, like, a major character is introduced kind of almost offhandedly with, what is it? Bill Camp's character saying, "Hey, what if we called Holly Gibney for that?" You know,
right,
and it's
right,
like, yeah. You know, I just like that, like that her, she's introduced kind of virtually, like she's not in the room. You know, we hear about her before we see her. And I kind of like that, for some like kind of dramaturgical reason or something. But, and then, you know, and I think that part of that is because they almost want to prepare you for the character, being, you know, sort of much more affected and, you know, idiosyncratic than a lot of the kind of more like rumpled, regular kind of small town folk that are otherwise populate the show. Cause she's decidedly not of that, of their world. And I think that maybe some of that is like telegraphed by the fact that she is Black and the rest of the main cast, for the most part, are white people. And, you know, I don't know. So I think that there's an interesting sort of textual way that they establish Holly's difference. And then you have the actual sort of, you know, her speaking patterns, her thought patterns, which are, certainly different from the more sort of slow, considered, tones of the other characters in the show.
Yeah. So she's, I believe the phrase they're using is neuroatypical, meaning she's on a behavioral sort of spectrum, but there's also, as is mentioned in this episode, you know, she underwent all these tests as a kid to sort of figure out what was going on with her. And I think the quote is like, "fuck if I know" was the official diagnosis. And so we're dealing with something that is beyond or different from, you know, other depictions of Asperger's or autism that we've seen on the screen before. And something that Cynthia Erivo said, like, I was a little hesitant about this because I like didn't know this about the character. And, so at first I was a little, like, because the stereotype of the defective detective, which is like what they called Monk, right? This like thing mm-hmm. of like, someone who has, you know, a different behavioral interactions with people, but that makes them a better detective, like is something that is a little worn out and sometimes very poorly executed, in TV. But when I was watching this performance, I'm like, I really liked the way that though she, you know, presents some of these characteristics, there is also like genuine connection there for her. And Cynthia Erivo talked about exactly that, that she did not want to have this character. Now, some people, I'm not, you know, educated enough to talk about this in any sort of like authoritative way. So please do not take offense if I say something incorrect. I'm definitely trying not to. And if I do send this something incorrect, please like feel free to email me. But like, definitely there are some people on this spectrum of behavior who do not have the ability to connect in meaningful ways with people. And something that, you know, Cynthia Erivo said is that she wanted this character of Holly to be a character who connected. And like, I have her quote from the TCA here. She said, with every connection she is, I wanted her to connect as much as she could. With every connection, she is learning to communicate and allows people to figure out who she is and what she is experiencing. And then she said, not all of us are good at communicating. With every connection, she's learning to communicate and thread ideas. And so I really liked this. The first introduction we get from her is she's like rattling off facts about cars. Then we get this phone call, but then we get this bar scene like directly after where there's someone sitting in her seat. She says, "You're sitting in my seat," which is like something that I think feels familiar if we've seen, a character on the spectrum before.
Mm-hmm.
But then she goes like, "You're okay. you know, it's not like a rigid, it's like a, you're okay, but you're sitting in my seat. And then that, I don't know what to say. I don't know. Maybe people watching or listening have a different idea about this, but I just think that it seems to me to not trying to like play it for laughs or play it for like whatever in the way that I think some other shows have done in the past, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, and I think it's a tricky thing because, it is a broad spectrum, you know, as we come to understand, neuroatypicality more, not just medically, but culturally and, you know, artistically, you know, and in all ways that people exist in the world, there is room for a lot of variance. I think that one of the things in television in particular, is that you don't want to make that, an oddity. You know, you don't want Holly's presence in the show to be just like another weird detail of this, you know, increasingly supernaturally weird show. You know, I think that would be a real sort of disservice to people who live, you know, lives that are perfectly unodd for them, you know, in the world. And so I think thus far I haven't seen that trope kind of manifesting, which is a relief because when she first showed up, I was a little like, uh-oh, like I tensed myself thinking back to like Diane Kruger inelegantly playing an autistic woman, on The Bridge, on that FX show that I think lasted a season or two, you know, but I think there's something a little bit more thoughtful happening here. And, you know, that's owed to Erivo, obviously, but also the show's writers and directors, like, maybe even the source material, like, that there's, you know, some at least keener understanding. And I have hope that her character, you know, is given fair treatment as the series goes on.
And to circle back to your mention of like how she's introduced, you hear her name before you meet her. That may partially be because Holly Gibney is a character who has appeared in other Stephen King books.
Mm-hmm.
She's in the Bill Hodges trilogy, like Mr. Mercedes. And there was actually, there is a TV adaptation of Mr. Mercedes. And on that show, Justine Loop, I think it's a Loop. It might be Lupe, who we know, from Succession, played, Holly Gibney on that show. And she's a white actress. And so, you know, this was, I like what you have to say about the way in which Cynthia Erivo, from her like more polished city mannerisms and from, you know, being the only non-white male on this core team, even though there is more diversity in Ralph's department, makes her stand out in other ways, you know, as not part of this hometown team, if that makes sense. So.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, it's my understanding, that like, she is the kind of one of the main characters of the show, you know, so I think that like she's gonna, in the coming episodes, like she will get her due. And it's an interesting time for Erivo as an actress, you know, which having just gotten an Oscar nomination for Harriet and.
Yeah. Well, this is, you know, last year around this time we were doing True Detective, with Mahershala Ali, who then went on to win an Oscar. And of course, Matthew McConaughey won his Oscar right after he did True Detective. So this like, this January HBO prestige detective show slot is nothing but a positive for your Oscar campaign. So there you go. It's interesting to me. Richard Price at this panel at TCA talked about sort of the liberties that he took with the book. Like he's given the Stephen King book. He says, King gives you a good story and good characters, but the book is not a teleplay, so you have to convert all of that to visuals. And he said that the differences that he wanted to do is specifically with the Holly Gibney character, that Stephen King, the only thing that Stephen King, he said, pushed back on was like, please just, can you call her Holly Gibney? That's like the only thing that he insisted on. And Stephen King has this thing that he does where he connects the material between a lot of his books. You have recurring characters in different, you know, you've got like, the setting of Derry, Maine is a recurring thing in King. So it's just like, it's part of the way that he weaves his universe. And so he's like, okay, you can make Holly different in your story, but I still want her to be Holly Gibney so that she is connected to the rest of this universe. But Richard Price, for his part, was like, I'm not even considering the Mr. Mercedes, like the other Holly Gibney stuff. He's like, as far as I'm concerned, that does not exist in my version of Holly. So that's sort of where we are in terms of like who this Holly Gibney is versus like other Holly Gibneys you might have seen on the screen. So, and I also, go ahead.
I also think it's interesting in the scene where she first meets, Ralph and she immediately gets talking about the topic of doppelgangers and, you know, all the sort of, folklore throughout so many cultures that basically speaks about the same idea, of a sort of insidious double. I think it's, that's another kind of interesting, tweak on a tropey character, or what could have been a tropey character, because, you know, we're used to getting the sort of, you know, like the Jim Parsons on Big Bang Theory, where the person, you know, is obsessed with technicality and has no sort of magical thinking and no imagination, you know, and I think that can be a limiting and unfair, depiction of people. And so I like that she's kind of the one who's like, I'm going to consider everything, and like, I'm to find this stuff interesting. I find the other stuff, the factual stuff interesting. And I like that kind of breadth of her, investigative purview.
I also like that even if we're having a sort of like Mulder and Scully dynamic between her and Ralph, who's like, I have no tolerance for, you know, the supernatural. And then she's like, well, then you'll have no tolerance for me, by the way. But I already like their connection in two points in this episode. One, when she leaves that scene, of course, there's that part where she says, you know, you don't drink that much, but you did it to make me feel comfortable. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Great stuff. And then later when she calls him and she says, sometimes I just like to like hear the voice of someone who's on my side. And so like the fact that she already can, even if they don't see eye to eye on this, that she already considers him someone on her side. And also that is an extremely relatable, I'm like, yeah, same. I also sometimes like to hear the voice of someone who's on my side. So, hopefully we all have a Ben Mendelsohn on speed dial that we can call to be on our side. I like this introduction and I really like her. The reviews for the show, you know, your review on VF.com was positive, but the reviews are mixed. But most people who reviewed the show seem to say like, but Cynthia Erivo though, you know, like that she is a really bright standout. For me, I like the show a lot and I could personally watch Ben Mendelsohn just be like silently sad and then her like, you know, do some spooky stuff and be really happy. So I'm pretty happy about all of it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, just to go into more of the rest of the episode that like, you know, I watch a ton of cooking videos and cooking shows and everything. And they always talk about like balancing fat with acid or sort of whatever, you know, sweetness with heat or whatever, you know, like in finding that balance. And I think that given what else is happening in this episode where we have a guy slitting his own throat, we have a detective who is now under the thrall of something, we think, you know, it's exactly when Holly needed to arrive to kind of let the show still have a little bit of air to it, a little bit of levity to it, or at least maybe hope to it that someone is going to figure out what's happening. Cause otherwise I feel like this episode would have been just like this grim slog into more and more horror without any sort of light, in on the horizon.
Yeah, no, I agree with that.
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week, we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
When, like, speaking of the cooking shows that you watch, what do you think the flavor profile of the sauce at Big Daddy's Hangry Barbecue is?
Well, I bet that's a night. I bet it's perfectly balanced, got the right tang. What I don't want to know is what the flavor profile of that goo they find all over everything in the barn. I have no interest in knowing that.
No interest in tasting the goo? All right.
No.
That's good. All right. So we open in the barn with the Maitland clothing. And so we have our, this character, Eunice Sablo, played by, Yul Vasquez, who we talked about last week. And what winds up happening is we basically have like a core team, which is Eunice Ablo, Howard Solomon, Detective Ralph Anderson, Alec Pelley, and Holly Gibney. These five people have decided to kind of take this investigation into their own hands because they're not satisfied with the Terry Maitland answer, and they know no one else is going to, like, solve this case if they don't. So despite the fact that, like, Ralph is on mental health leave, he is on this investigation. Always a good sign. So they find these clothes, these goop clothes, and the angry cop that we met last week, Jack, has to go up to the barn to investigate. And he's pretty angry about it. That seems to be his character profile entirely. And so we get this scene with him at the strip club. So you had said last week, you've seen more episodes than I have, just a few more, but, like, you said last week that the strip club stuff felt kind of like vestigial, sort of like this weird satellite thing. Like, why are we back to this setting sort of thing? But you and I both, I think, are fans of the actor Patty Considine, who plays the, you know, club manager or whatever. And so it's one of those cases where I'm like, you don't cast him to not do more, right? So, like, I'm almost wondering, and I haven't seen, this is pure speculation, but I'm like, is he going to get infected or doppelganged at some point? Are we going to get to see him do something cool and weird? But he seemed to be, you know, he seemed to notice both the bad behavior of this guy pre-spooky rash and post-spooky rash. What's your take on the use of the strip club here?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, the strip club as a sort of as a sort of venue for us to see his bad behavior. You know, I guess it's an interesting setting that reveals a certain kind of side of one's personality, maybe, and that's kind of what it's being used dramatically for. But also, if Jack is infected with, or whatever is going on, you know, we still don't know. If he's always at the strip club acting out anyway, maybe that will come to bear later in the story. Because I think that this episode also has the tricky thing of we have another kind of side plot in the whole prison thing. Right. That would maybe seems to resolve itself to some extent by the end of this episode, but then you also have this other stuff. So it's a tricky, you know, going back to balance. And I don't know if the episode 100% balances that, just partly because I'm just waiting for whatever the whole strip club, you know, arena of the world is meant to mean in the grander scheme of things.
Right. And I'm like, the most cynical side of me is like, is this here just so that HBO can get its, like, we're HBO, mm-hmm. like,
right.
Adult, mature content angle, and I hope that's not the case. But I think so. They need to show Jack acting out as he did in the last two episodes, so that I think my guess would be so that once he starts acting out, if he is infected with something, and he's like acting out, like it'll take longer for people around him to notice because he's always been a grumpy, right, shitty dude, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have a really important question for you, Richard. Mm. If you were to get some sort of spooky rash on the back of your neck, or spooky wound, shrapnel, whatever you want to call it, how would you treat it? How would you treat said wound?
However, my new dark master told me to treat it. I mean, you know, but this is all hypothetical, right? I mean, you're not implying anything about me, right?
I definitely have not sent a spooky rash your way. I feel like slathering it in Neosporin is just like one step up from slathering it in like Daddy's Hangry Barbecue Sauce or something like that. I'm like,
right.
You put Neosporin on it, bud? Like, that's it? You got hit with questionable materials in a spooky barn. Like, it felt like he still had some mastery over his brain at that point in the episode. I don't know. Anyway.
Well, he's a tough feral hog hunter. He's not going to go to no damn doctor.
It's
true. He's going to take care of it himself.
F those doctors. We'll see what happens there, what develops there. I, for one, I feel like we get it. We get that he's been infected with something through his neck. What I don't need to see is that rash getting worse. I don't need to see any more close-up shots of that rash, like, burbling up or anything. Like, we've done it. I get it. Hopefully that's it for that. All right. So let's talk about this jail, through line that we get, which is an introduction. We are basically at a loss for most of the episode as to why we're watching this. I think once you see this prisoner get this, like, child killer letter, it kind of, you're kind of like, oh, he's another Terry, maybe falsely imprisoned for killing a kid. That was my guess. But basically what happens is, like, we see him. He sees this dude who he seems to recognize, sort of get admitted into the prison. He, after he sees that, he starts making his own little glass, shiv out of, you know, his glasses lens. And then we see the dude who just checked into prison. It's called checking into prison, right? Like a hotel. The dude who just checked into prison.
He talks to the valet and the concierge and
Right. Checks his bags and then removes a shiv from inside his calf. Something I did not need to know about. So he's got the shiv ready to go. And basically, you know, he goes to attack, this inmate, and this inmate slits his own throat. He's like, you don't get to do this. I'm going to cut myself. And so
it was great to see, Sarah Snook, though, kind of do like an HBO crossover thing as Shiv.
love a Shiv, cameo. But so the thing we find out is that, that Holly discovers the connection. Like, we're in the dark for much of the episode, but Holly discovers the connection for us, which is that, this young man who slit his throat seems to have been Terry Maitland's dad's, like worked in the hospital where Terry Maitland's dad, Peter, I think his name is Peter Maitland, is hospitalized for, like Alzheimer's, basically. And, was convicted for the murder of two young girls, the Williams sisters. So this, you know, seems to be like a vengeance killing. Like, it all kind of makes sense to me, right? Like, this guy gets himself arrested so he can be in the prison, so he can take his revenge. Sort of similar, a similar closing of the loop as what happened with the Maitland murder, right?
Right.
And so, you almost think that maybe this is part of the whole, like, if there is a doppelganger or whatever, part of his, like, tying up of loose threads is, like, sending a grieving family member to go murder the person that he doppelganged? Question mark?
Right. I guess we don't really know who the murderer was, you know, or the would-be murderer, rather. The guy with the shiv in his leg, you know. And I looked, and there was one shot, maybe a couple shots. He didn't have bubbles on the back of his neck, I don't think.
Right. So I don't know. I almost feel like, and the girls who were missing were African American, and he was white. So, like, not, probably not like a brother or whatever. But I don't know. It seemed like what seemed to be true is that the guy who slit his throat recognized him and recognized him as someone who would want to do him harm. Right.
Or he recognized not this individual guy. I mean, but he recognized the malevolent force that was going to come get him no matter what. Right. You know, because we saw with the Maitland thing, like, that this doesn't just kill the pretend killer. It kills the parents and brother of the murder victim. Like, you know, this thing, its concentric circles are pretty wide. And so, like, maybe this guy who's now stuck in prison for something he maybe didn't do has seen it kind of take out every, like, a bunch of other people and was just kind of waiting for this, you know?
Right. It's that scene from episode two still really sticks out to me, right? Which is when the father of the young boy who was killed, like, tries to hang himself, and then we get that, like, long shot out the window to the hooded figure who seemed to have, like, you know, I mean, I'm extrapolating, but it seems to me like, yeah, that he compelled this suicide. It's all tying up loose ends, or just, you know, making sure, but, like, it almost seems like fairy tale ritualistic. Like, if you kill a child, eat part of the child. And then, like, also there's the, like, what happens to the community or the community around the child. So I don't know. That's all part of it.
Yeah.
All right. And the way in which we know, or we think we know, that a malevolent force might be hanging around, like, still guiding the investigation and closing up loops, one other way we know is through Terry Maitland's daughter, who is having these dreams.
Or visitations.
So we have, the Maitland girls have been expelled from school, which seems illegal to me. Okay. So they've been kicked out of school because of all the drama surrounding their dad. And then the youngest one is having these like incidents in the nighttime, curious incidents in the nighttime, and insists on talking to Ralph.
The curious incident of the dad in the nighttime.
Ooh, just change one letter, and to get us there. So her mom, Glory Maitland, takes her, very grudgingly, it seems, over, to the Anderson household. And I really love this sequence.
Yeah.
Of young Jessa Maitland talking about what she had seen, Ralph trying to talk to her, Glory cutting it off. And then we get, so that leaves room for Jeannie Anderson, Ralph's wife, to play a role in this, and for the show to like pass the Bechdel test or whatever. So like, what did you make of this like whole, Jessa stuff?
Does it pass the Bechdel pit test? They were talking about a man, whether or not it's a human man, you know.
Spooky man.
I like, it's interesting when she says like daddy, but like messy or something, you know?
Yeah.
And the way that it so neatly dovetails or ties into the great scene with Yul Vasquez toward the beginning of the episode where he's running down like the very, very, big irregularities or oddities about the fingerprint analysis.
Yes.
Where it's like Terry Maitland's fingerprints, but like if he were 90 years old, which I didn't know like the whorls and treads or whatever of your fingerprints wore down as you aged, but I guess it makes sense, but it's kind of depressing to think about. But anyway,
this is why more old folks should do crimes. This is why there's so many movies about old folks doing crimes.
Yeah, we're like literally fading from the world. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
But you know, I thought that was interesting, and I didn't notice Ralph register that, you know, that, I mean, because she didn't say it looked like daddy, but old, like maybe if she'd said that, it would have been like, that would have been Ralph's big light bulb moment, but I'm sure he'll put it together. But I think that little actress is, she's good. And, I love that they're giving Mare Whittingham's character so much to do.
Me too.
You know, she's got a good energy. She's kind of like Holly in that way where it's like, you know, they're pragmatic thinkers, and they, even if Holly has a kind of more, can also go off on sort of bigger tangents, like, you know, I just think they add a certain competency, I guess, to the proceedings that, again, help kind of offset the really like physically gross stuff that is happening elsewhere in this episode.
Right. And you just like the Andersons. Mm-hmm. I like the way that Ralph interacts with he's good with kids, seems to me. As his wife. They were probably great parents, you know. So she says, Jessa says, first of all, I actually just like love Jessa Maitland, right? Like she's like, first of all, she calls, Ralph, Ben Mendelsohn's character, the sad looking one. I'm like, nailed it, my dear. We should just like tattoo that on Ben Mendelsohn. It's perfect. Yeah. And then she says his skin was wrong. What a fun, creepy thing to say.
Mm-hmm.
And then she also says he was trying to make me cry. And then she's like, I'm not scared by him. I'm mad. He's trying to scare you. Like, this is all great. I do think that we're supposed to understand that Ralph absorbed some of like, maybe he didn't have like a big aha light bulb moment, but the way they do, what is that split focus shot called? Where you see the women on the stairs, and then you see Ralph at the bottom of the stairs, and they're both in focus. There's a technical,
I'm not sure
for it. But anyway, I think we're meant to like register his face as he's taking in this information, from her. Is it called a Doppler shot? I think that's right.
Well, the thing about this is that the show hopefully is going to be careful, because I don't love it when on these kind of investigation shows, be they supernatural or not, where there is, you know, the viewer at home is like put, like has already put together some connections because we've been shown things. So we know more in certain cases than the investigators do. But I don't like when they drag it out for dramatic effect with that investigator, like it taking a really long time to accept that two things are related. You know what I mean? Like, so I'm curious to see how the show paces that out in the coming episodes, because, you know, this is not a terribly long season of television. So like, eventually they're going to have to take that turn where like everyone involved accepts the parameters of what we in the audience kind of are already on board with thinking. But I also really liked, speaking about like storytelling, I really liked, the scene between Glory, and sorry, Mayor Whittingham, sorry. Why am I? Oh, and Jeannie, where they talk about, where Glory tells the story about like, oh, you know, one of my girls like went to a sleepover and an older brother at the house like made them watch Leprechaun, and she came home so scared of leprechauns, and I kept telling her they didn't exist and that didn't work. She just dug her heels in. But then Terry was like, no, they do exist, but they live in Ireland and they can't leave. And I thought that was, I mean, if that is direct from King, or even if it's from Price, like just that kind of like, it's an interesting way to look at storytelling and suspension of disbelief. It's like, it's much better to kind of go with an idea and give it parameters that sort of make it almost seem realer than just kind of outright, I don't know, deny something or sort of, I don't know, be absolutist about it, I guess. Yeah. I don't know. I thought that was a nice little scene.
Yeah. I loved that scene. And once again, like, maybe it didn't pass the Bechdel test because they were talking about Terry, but, you know,
and the leprechaun as a man
and the leprechaun, but like, to make room for Glory and, Jeannie, these two moms. And especially like when, you know, Jeannie asks, like, how did you ever like get over losing your son? Basically, she's like, you don't, you know, like it's just, you don't. And mm-hmm. so like to have space for those two women to talk to each other, I think that's something that True Detective, would never think to do. Maybe it's unfair for me to compare this to True Detective, but like, it feels like a move that True Detective wouldn't do, to be like, let's leave room for these two women to talk to each other about like loss and motherhood and stuff like that. And I also like, us getting more like, I think Jason Bateman did a great job, and Bateman talked about this on the panel about how like, you know, it was a timing thing in terms of like, he was asked to be part of this project. He wanted to be part of this project, but he's got his time commitment to Ozark over Netflix. And so like, he could only like do a 2-episode stint basically as acting and directing, which is, I mean, the character dies early in the books, but like, that's why Jason Bateman is playing such a small role on this show. He even said that they had to like push back production on Ozark in order for him to be able to do this. So, but I think he does such a good job of, establishing the character of Terry Maitland, partially because we know Jason Bateman and like, you know, so, it's an easy access to that character. He has that great Bunting monologue, that he tells in episode 2. But I think hearing about him in this way from Glory is another really nice moment in the episode where it's just like, this is what was lost for her, right? Like her mm-hmm. parenting partner. And this is part of what the investigation is about. The investigation is about making sure this doesn't happen to another kid, but it's also about clearing Terry Maitland's name. And if he was like a nice dad who had good ideas about how to talk to children about leprechauns, then, you know, that's something we're rooting for.
Yeah, for sure.
The other thing that we get in this episode that I really like is, we get a therapy session for Ralph and, who's on like, you know, mental health leave or whatever. And, I really, once again, I think something this show is doing a really good job of is presenting me with a scenario, that I've seen many times before, but doing it at a slightly off-kilter angle in a way that makes it more interesting and dynamic television. So the cop who clearly has emotional issues to work through, who has to go to therapy but doesn't want to go to therapy, so is resistant to therapy, is like something we've seen before. But they lampshade it a bit in that, you know, Ralph is like, I know what you're doing. I've, you know, interrogated people before. You sitting there quietly, I get it, I've done it, you know, blah, blah. And then I like the way this scene is written for what it draws out. It draws out a lot, but not too much. And, you know, hopefully we'll get more, but just like this exploration, the fact that this show has room to explore his marriage and that relationship and everything that's going on there. Like, I just think that that's a really interesting thing to have space for, in a show like this, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think the interesting thing that they're setting up, with Ralph and with Glory and Jeannie and then a little bit further down, like the other characters, is Ralph and Jeannie and Glory are at that moment, like, pretty convinced that the world is dark and malevolent, or not, if not malevolent, it is, it's predicated on pain. It tends toward pain, you know, and then here we have this potentially supernatural thing sort of looming almost to confirm that. And so if they do, as the season goes on, you know, if Ralph does, in particular, Ralph comes to accept that reality, the kind of emotional journey of his character will be seeing how he processes that. Does he kind of feel validated that he was right, that like the world is harsh, or does, you know, does Glory, you know, feel that same way, or do they kind of accept it and then move past it, you know? And I think that's the kind of like allegorical thing that King is, you know, often does in his work. I'm told, I've only again seen film and TV adaptations of his work, but, so I think that therapy scene is a really good example of like, you know, this show understanding the kind of the groundwork it needs to lay to get to the big, you know, Woody Harrelson and Matthew McConaughey looking at the stars at the end of True Detective moment. You know, it takes a while to get right there when your show is ostensibly a detective show, you know?
Right.
So yeah, but I love the kind of, I'm assuming that's a Richard Pricey thing of like laying out like an actual sort of like technique for interrogation. You know, like, which I'm sure, yeah, is used by, you know, detectives and otherwise in the real world.
Yeah, it's interesting to me. I feel like usually with these, like, grieving detective characters, we get, like, you know, someone who's, like, hard drinking or what, you know, like, stuff that we, like, hard-boiled detective noir stuff, the kind of stuff that we see in True Detective, to present us with Ralph Anderson, who's like, seems to be just like a nice guy who like loves his wife, and his wife seems to be great. Like, that, I'm like, thank you for giving me something different, something very different. And then Holly, you know, seems to enjoy drinking and to deal with the stuff that she has to deal with. But, you know, it's just, I'm like, it just feels like they're trying to give us something fresh, and I really appreciate that. And I think a lot of that is the Price touch, because King at this point, if I'm being honest with you, I like Stephen King, but at this point, I'm not sure how fresh his takes are, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, and I didn't mean to imply that, like, that, Ralph or anyone on this show is a nihilist, you know? I think if anyone is, maybe Glory, but like, I think more, it's more just like, you know, the world has done a number on these people, you know, for seemingly arbitrary reasons, or no reason at all. And so I think that, like, I'm just interested to see how they confront a kind of physical manifestation of that.
Right. Absolutely. No. I know what you meant. All right. So let us talk, once again about Holly. I have a question for you that I don't know that we know the answer to, which is, we see her go to this hotel room where the Maitland family stage. We see Glory and the girls. My question for you is, like, we see her standing in the, you know, pristine hotel room, and then we see the bustle of the girls and Glory around her and the mess of the Maitland family staying there. And then it goes back to pristine. Are we meant to think that Holly can, like, see any of this stuff? Or was that just there to help us understand where she was, in the world?
My hunch is it's the latter. I think it was a storytelling device, a visual storytelling device, because I think there was like, what's this room she's standing in? And maybe they didn't want to have the scene where she goes to the front desk and asks for the specific room, you know, or whatever.
Right.
But, you know, you never know with these things. I mean, you know, King, you know, The Shining is something that's used in a lot of his like Dark Tower world, you know, is the, some kind of telepathy or whatever, you know, sixth sense. So maybe that's part of what's going on. But again, we then run risks of how neuroatypicality is presented, and maybe this suggestion that there's a supernatural element to it wouldn't be very good. So I'm hoping it's not I think I'm hoping it was just a device for this one scene.
Yeah, we'll see how it unfolds. Something that I did like that we see is we see her put out a few religious totems, sort of in this space where she's staying, from varying faiths. Is my understanding of what we're seeing there, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I don't know. I just think that that's interesting. That like,
yeah,
she believes in the supernatural, but she's also like, and I also really loved when she was talking about doppelgangers, and she's talking about like, you know, I think it's perhaps a way for people to explain bipolar disorder or whatever. And I don't know. I like what I'm seeing so far about her idea. Like, she believes in the unexplainable, but also in myths that crop up trying to explain the unexplainable. But also, you know, is comforted by the presence of these various religious totems. I just think that that's all kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
And then I also really like, so the scene that she goes to the hospital to try to see Terry's dad, I like that she like lies pretty well for a minute there, about trying to get in to see him. And, once again, I feel that that's something, sorry, I made a mistake at the top of the show by calling it like neuroatypical. I think the preferred term is neurodiverse. I think when we see, bad examples of neurodiversity on television, not bad examples, I don't know, more played for laughs or whatever, there isn't I could never see, like, Monk doing that. You know what I mean? I was just like, oh, she's lying. That's interesting. So I don't know. I think that it's interesting. I think it's all, complicated and unboxable, which is something that I like from my characters in television. So
yeah, and it's not played for comedy, you know, for easy comedy.
Exactly.
Anyway.
Exactly.
So
the last thing I think that I want to say, and then I think we did it. There seems to like, so the way we understand what we've seen in this episode, an orderly someone who worked in the hospital where Peter Maitland was, either became infected or was doppelganged and like killed a child, right? And then Terry goes and visits his dad, and then he's doppelganged. So it feels like, as you say, like the van, like that line about the van following you home, like maybe not the van, but maybe like, you know, like a presence followed him home from this hospital, which makes me think that the character of Peter Maitland, if we ever meet him, might have some interesting things to say about, you know, both this hospital worker and his son. You know, he's the linchpin between those two things.
Right.
So,
and we're gonna presumably the cut that he got at the hospital, at the nursing home,
right,
that Terry got,
right,
is gonna come into play or something, you know. So
right, exactly, this idea. Yeah, interesting. All right, so did I miss anything? Did we?
No, I think that's it.
I mean, there's Big Daddy's Hangry Barbecue Mall Cop. Shout out to you.
Oh yeah, he's a good actor. I don't know his name, but he's in stuff. So, yeah, and you know, I think that like, I'm not like. I'm glad you said it, because I'm just like really not looking forward to that neck rash getting worse.
Just don't want to see it. Like,
I don't want to see it either.
That's,
we know
like
it's
a
there.
Horror trope. Yeah, that's a horror trope of like a festering wound, you know, and like we already saw a guy dig around in his own dang calf in this episode.
And pull Sarah Snook out. It was horrifying.
Who knew Australians could be so compact? But yeah, I don't need to see it. So hopefully we won't get it, but we might because of Stephen King. Is there anything else that you're like curious about or looking forward to seeing more of, in future episodes?
I'm just eager for everyone to like get on board and like have, you know, be like, you know, I like the early stages where everyone is kind of on either side or doubting things, but like, I'm just getting a little impatient for the gang to really like be unified and be the bad guy, I guess.
All right. So here's hoping that Ralph has a swift turnaround. I'm thinking it's going to be a slow road. We've got some more episodes to go.
But yeah.
We'll see. All right. Until episode 4, Richard, where can folks find you?
Well, I'm going to just be kind of holed up. I got a draft of the next Leprechaun movie script due like really soon, and I'm way behind. So I'm going to be doing that. But I might take a break or two here and there to tweet at Rylaws and to write things coming up pretty soon from the Sundance Film Festival for VF.com. And what about you, Joanna?
Very exciting. Well, I am stuck in LA for a couple more days, but you can find me on VanityFair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. I will be slathering Neosporin on any wound that I might encounter, because apparently that's what one does. And once again, you can email us, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. We love your emails. We have theories, questions, especially feedback to some of our conversations about neurodiversity, which, you know, Richard and I are always trying to be like as thoughtful as we can be about stuff like this. Sometimes there might be blind spots for us. So if we miss something, please do email us, and we'd love to discuss your emails. Otherwise, we will see you at Big Daddy's Hangry Barbecue, next week.
Want to stay up to date on the biggest stories in pop culture and entertainment? Then be sure to check out the TMZ podcast. I'm Charlie Cotton from TMZ, the TV show, and every day I'll sit down with a member of our news team to give exclusive breakdowns of the day's most talked about headlines, stories we break, and the stories you care about. So check out the TMZ podcast, Monday through Friday, and the other podcasts from the TMZ audio network like Last Days and TMZ Verified, available on all podcast platforms.